Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, April 30th. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is my first guest today, and in a different way than usual. As many of you know, the senator from New York generally comes on with us once a month to take calls from constituents, and she will do that today. But today is also different, because one of the changes that she's been trying to bring as a member of the Armed Services Committee seems to be on the verge of a breakthrough. Her goal is to have sexual assault cases in the military prosecuted by someone other than the local commanding officer, the reason they too often protect the perpetrators. We'll talk about other things too, including the implications for women's rights of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, President Biden's American Families Plan, and more depending on time. But her possible breakthrough on prosecuting sexual assault in the military is our lead. So, Senator Gillibrand, always good to have you. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, it's a pleasure.
Senator, would you remind people of the problem you're trying to address with sexual assault in the military and how cases of that are handled?
So the problem is there is a scourge of sexual violence in the military, and the justice system in the military isn't working to help and to provide justice for survivors. 2018, every 2 years, the military has an estimate of how many sexual assaults there are. In 2018, that estimate was about 20,000. But when you look at the details of how many people reported and how many people got their cases moved forward to trial and how many cases ended in conviction, the rate of prosecution and the rate of conviction has gone down, and it's the lowest it's been in the 10 years that the military has been tracking these statistics. So we're just not moving in the right direction on any measurable. And so I have been trying for the last 8 years to change how we deal with these cases. Because when you talk to survivors and you ask them, you know, were you sexually assaulted? Did you report? Why didn't you report? The reason over and over again is they didn't trust the chain of command would have their back. And that's not surprising because Fort Hood just did a study on what was happening there. And they found that the command climate was so toxic that it was permissible for harassment and assault within the ranks. And so it's the problem is that the commanders have maintained for the last 10 years I've been working on this that they have to be in charge of everything, that they're the only ones who can bring good order and discipline. But the truth is they're failing in this very way. And so right now, commanders are the ones who decide whether a case goes to trial. They also pick the judge, the jury, the prosecutor, and the defense counselor. So they're in charge of everything. So if you don't believe your commander has your back, then you don't believe the chain of command will be able to move your case and actually get a conviction. And unfortunately, that's what the result is. The other problem has been record high retaliation rates. About 60% of men and women who come forward to report assault, instead of getting justice, they are retaliated against for bringing their cases forward. So our solution is to let trained military prosecutors do one thing. Let them decide whether or not the case should go to trial. If they do that one thing, then survivors will know that's an unbiased individual who's highly trained and a lawyer is the one who's going to decide whether their case should move forward. That will create trust in the system, and I believe it'll result in more cases going to trial and more convictions.
I saw that a New York Times article on this week cited Republican Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa and a key member of the other party, obviously, who seems to be coming to your point of view on this in a way that might matter a lot politically, because you've been trying to get this through for a while and haven't been able to get it passed. So can you say anything about Senator Ernst's own story or your talks with her about the issue?
Yes. So we've had about half the Senate or over half the Senate over the last 8 years supporting this bill. Widely bipartisan. Mitch McConnell, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, and Chuck Schumer, Bernie Sanders, and Liz Warren have all supported this bill for a long time. However, there's just been this last group of people that it's been really hard to convince because they've been unwilling to either take on the chain of command or not follow the DOD. And with Joni Ernst, supporting this bill, it does change everything, because she is not only a combat veteran herself, she's a former commander herself, and she's also a sexual assault survivor. She has looked at this issue over the last 6 years with me. We've tried to put in place lots of different reforms together, things that the DOD was comfortable with. We've moved that legislation, and none of it is moving the needle. And so Joni got to the point this year where she said enough is enough. If the statistics keep going in the wrong direction, then all the things we've put in place over the last 8 years isn't enough. We need professionalism. We need a trained military prosecutor to do this. And we need to have transparency and accountability. And so her joining has already resulted in several Republicans joining the bill. And it's given confidence to some of the more moderate Democrats that this is an idea whose time has come. And so we've just signed on at least a dozen senators who were not with us before, both Democrat and Republican, because of this new coalition. And it's really meaningful.
When's the vote?
So we can ask for an up or down vote on this issue, but we may choose to just wait for the defense bill. We are very close to having a majority of the committee and 60 senators. So I'm going to try to lobby this a couple more weeks to see if I can get to 60 co-sponsors or a majority of the Armed Services Committee. If that happens, then we can go to the Armed Services Committee and say we want this in the base bill. Because we can win this on the floor. And if I can assure that this is in the base Armed Services markup, then we will do it that way, because then we just get to turn it into law, which is the goal.
There are now some women in high-ranking leadership positions in the Pentagon where there weren't before. As you know, Kathleen Hicks as Deputy Defense Secretary, second in command there, and Christine Wormuth has been nominated to become Secretary of the Army. She'd be the first woman in that position, pending confirmation by the Senate. I'm curious how much you think those roles matter to legal or cultural changes that need to take place in our nation's armed forces.
So interestingly, Brian, your gender does not determine what you think on all issues. And so we have not necessarily had support from within the DOD, even amongst female leaders. I do believe that both of these new appointees may well support our position, but they have not made that public yet. I know that President Biden has supported this position, certainly from the campaign trail, and has been an ally for a long time. And he has asked his Secretary of Defense, General Austin, to do a 90-day review, which they've done, and they're soon to release it. That report's been leaked, and they do agree that these decisions should be taken out of the chain of command. We also just heard that Admiral Mullen, who, if you remember, was the leader on repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, he just came out and said that he has resisted this change for the last decade, but given where we are and the lack of progress, he also now supports removing the decision-making for sexual violence out of the chain of command. And so we are gaining momentum with military leaders to support this. We haven't, though, and this is relevant, had active duty service members articulate that view. The reason why Admiral Mullen's testimony when we were doing Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal was so important is because he was serving the administration at the time he gave that statement. Mm-hmm. We have not heard a similar statement from active duty service members and commanders, largely because up until now they have been told they would be reprimanded for articulating support for our measure. So there's been a gag order on support. So things are changing, and I think they're changing because our commander-in-chief wants them to change, and when President Biden decides he wants to do this, it will be done. And I think most of our opponents will, at that point, realize that this is a change that's going to happen. But we are creating the groundswell now, and so we will be ready to turn this into law, regardless of how the commission that General Austin is running concludes. So we, as our job in the Senate to provide oversight over the administration and the armed services, we are standing ready to do our job.
Senator, since we were talking about protecting women in the context of your work on the Armed Services Committee, I'd like to ask how you see the president's decision to withdraw all U.S. forces from Afghanistan by September. That withdrawal began this week, as it affects women in that country and the brutal rule by the Taliban in that respect, girls' education, women's rights and safety in general.
So this is a very complex problem, Brian, and I believe it was time to draw down our troops from Afghanistan, given the commitment we've made for the last 20 years. But the problem with permanent basing in a country like Afghanistan and permanent investment, it's a huge sacrifice by the American people and our troops that are sent abroad. And it doesn't necessarily make us safer. The deployment of those troops was largely to defeat terrorism and respond to Osama bin Laden and the 9/11 attacks. And so we very intentionally worked very hard to defeat al-Qaeda and then the follow-on groups such as ISIS and ISIL. We still have terrorism throughout the world. It's continued to metastasize in different forms, in different places, finding footholds in Africa and in Asia and the Middle East. It is so easy today to find footholds in ungoverned places. And unfortunately, there's so many ungoverned places around the globe. And so the question is, do we want to spend trillions and trillions of dollars over the next 10 years to continue that investment? While, yes, it makes it easier for us to defeat terrorism in that part of the world, it doesn't necessarily protect the United States from terrorism. See the difference? And so it was a choice we had to make. Now, you bring up the biggest risk that I think the Afghani people face, mm-hmm. is when the Taliban begins to re-exert their power and control over the region, if the elected government isn't able to keep stability in the region, then a lot of the values that we have tried to promote will be deeply at risk. And that includes women's rights, it includes their democracy, it includes access to education. And so those are the risks. We are hoping that we can collaborate with the world community, with our NATO allies, to continue to strengthen the democratically elected government in Afghanistan, to protect women's rights and democracy. But again, we cannot project our power that far for that long unless it's going to make the difference of keeping America safe or not. And we can't.
Can the U.S. have on women's rights in Afghanistan? I'm not sure we had any influence on that as a result of the troop presence anyway. You could tell me your opinion on that. But without, you know, because the Pentagon or the president says, I believe the policy is we would send troops back in if Afghanistan becomes a haven for al-Qaeda or other international terrorist organizations again that are seen as a national security threat to the United States. But we're certainly not threatening that for the sake of domestic security for women within Afghanistan. So without that, what influence can the U.S. have?
So the way we traditionally project our values is through foreign aid and democratic support. So, for example, investments in Afghanistan. We could do joint ventures, help build hospitals, help build schools. We could do support through our allies and NATO, peacekeeping forces, if necessary. Like, there's ways to support the Afghan people going forward, but we just can't guarantee it. I think what the presence of our troops allowed for so long was that the Taliban couldn't overrun the government, and the Taliban couldn't infiltrate and commit violent acts in the regions where we had control. So that's what we were able to do over the last 20 years for the Afghan people. But again, the investment is so significant, and the net result of protecting us from terrorism, it just doesn't project far enough because our risks from terrorism are now global. We have risks from Iran, we have risks from China, we have risks from Russia, and the Middle East. So it's a decision that I think was important to make, and it was the right decision by President Biden. But we will do everything we can to keep trying to help Afghanistan protect democracy and protect women's rights. But it's hard. It's hard when it's not our country. And so I think this is the best we can do now. And we will stand ready, however, through special operations and other flexibility through our military to respond to terrorist risks and crises going forward. But I think the permanent long-term deployment has come to an end.
Let me ask you about President Biden's American Families Plan unveiled in his speech on Wednesday night. If it were to pass, it would provide 2 years of free public pre-K and a cap for most families of 7% of their income for other kinds of child care for children under five, as you know, and in addition to all the other provisions. But for example, on that child care, for our listeners who are confused by the numbers the way they were put out, a family making $70,000 a year with one child would not have to pay more than $4,900 a year for daycare, if I'm doing my math right. And we know it costs so much more than that. And we also know women have been hit so much harder economically than men in the pandemic economy because of the kinds of jobs they do disproportionately. So my question is, to what degree do you think these early childhood provisions would have gender equity effects? And is that part of the point?
Yes, it is part of the point. I think what President Biden laid out is a vision to invest in the human infrastructure that allows our society to function and allows our economy to grow. We've really seen during the pandemic how women have been so disproportionately harmed during this pandemic because of the fact that schools have been closed, child care centers have been closed, and families have had to make decisions about who will stay home with children. And while many families have two parents, more often than not, the women have been the ones to stay home. And as a result, 5.4 million women have lost their jobs during this pandemic, and many fear that they will not be able to get their careers back. And so what this family plans agenda is, it's basically the soft architecture and the soft infrastructure that binds and builds on the hard infrastructure that President Biden wants to rebuild. And so it allows for child care to get these child care centers back open again. Before the pandemic, there was one slot for every four kids that needed it. Today, there's one slot for every eight kids that need it in our state. So that will rebuild our child care centers. It will defray cost for child care so that it's affordable, because right now, child care is very expensive. For infant care in New York, it could be $12,000 a year or more. If you're a minimum wage worker or a low wage worker only earning between $15,000 and $30,000, you can't possibly afford that. Yes. So it'll make child care more affordable. There's lots of ways to do that legislatively. I have several bills to make a child care tax credit, double that, a child care tax deduction, double that, just plain old subsidies. There's lots of ways to get at affordability. It directs money for universal pre-K. To have the 3 and 4 year olds in pre-K is a structural change that makes a difference. It's better for the kids because they're getting early childhood education, getting their numbers and letters earlier, and being able to socialize with other children. It also helps parents get back to work during those 2 years, which really matters. It'll have paid family and medical leave, which is something I've been fighting for since 2013.
Right, we've been talking about that for years.
It's a huge issue, and this will be a way to start it, to make sure that families who have ill family members, sick spouses, sick children, or new infants, that all of those life events can be covered, and to have the flexibility that we certainly needed during this pandemic but didn't have. And then other things that I fought for, like increasing nutrition programs so kids get more meals at school, so that the pandemic EBT program continues, more money for women and infants through the WIC program. Those things matter. And so this family plan is very, very good news for working people in New York, because this is the infrastructure of their life. This is what allows them to thrive in the workplace and their children to thrive in education.
Of course, between that and the President's Jobs Act, there's $4 trillion of new spending on the table right now, and so far no Republican support. And the Washington Post ABC News poll out this week shows people tend to like these kinds of programs, but a majority also worries about the implications of so much government spending on inflation and maybe the future debt for those very kids that people would be subsidized to help raise. How do you balance those concerns?
So the truth is that our economy is really in shambles, and this pandemic has hit our country and the globe extremely hard. And so what is expected and what is needed is robust response, and we have to rebuild this economy. And what's so brilliant about this plan is it rebuilds all aspects of the economy, not just one part. So many Republicans would say, oh, we're happy to do the hard infrastructure. Like, we're happy to spend money on roads and bridges and sewers, and maybe they're happy to spend it on high-speed rail or rural broadband or health IT. But they don't want to do the child care, and they don't want to do the paid leave, and they don't want to do education. They just don't want to go in that direction. But the truth is, if you're just talking about rebuilding roads and bridges, that's a lot of good jobs, good middle-class jobs for men, largely white men. And so you're just leaving out whole swaths of the economy and good portions of our workforce. So you need to be more holistic. And infrastructure has always been redefined over time based on who's talking about it. Certainly 100 years ago, rural broadband and healthcare IT wouldn't be considered infrastructure. But today, of course, it is. And so so should be paid leave and early childhood education and daycare, because the economy can't function without it. So I think this is a very smart and thoughtful approach. I think politics is politics, so they have to criticize it somehow. But there are ways to pay for this that are fair and equitable. There's been 500 billionaires made during this pandemic. There were true swaths of this economy that not only thrived but benefited exponentially. And so I think having a progressive tax code that allows for people who are ultra wealthy, and I'm talking about making more than $5 and $10 million a year, the ultra wealthy can pay more to ensure the infrastructure that has frankly allowed them to succeed. Anyone who has made billions of dollars, it's because our infrastructure saved the economy, saved families, and kept everything up and running. And that success for them was on the backs of our critical workers. It was the fact that men and women showed up to work at hospitals and pharmacies and grocery stores every day, largely women of color. So if anything, they should be paying it back, because they are the winners of this moment, and they did not have to make the sacrifices that so many Americans had to make. And so I think you can definitely harmonize these ideas with our tax code in a way that's very fair and equitable.
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, we always appreciate it. Talk to you.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.